And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome from Denver. Yes, I've been sitting here next to Guy James, trying desperately to play engineer. If you hear the music swelling up in the background, it's because they're about to do the call to order. The convention will officially begin in seconds. They are announcing the chairman, Howard Dean, and I can actually play for you the live feed from the convention hall. Let's go. Let's go right to Howard Dean. Here he is.
The 45th Quadrennial National Convention of the Democratic Party will now come to order. Welcome, delegates, alternates, standing committee members, special guests, and other friends, members of the news media, guests from around the world, and our fellow Americans. During our national convention, we will demonstrate to all Americans why we need Barack Obama and Joe Biden in the White House. Looking out from this podium tonight, I see a diverse assembly of Democrats as a testament to the strength and unity of our party and the fruition of our 50-state strategy. While the Democratic Party is the oldest continuing party in the world, I can also see that we are the most vibrant and inclusive and energized party, and we are ready to compete in all 50 states. America realizes that we cannot have four more years of the same ineffective approach to governing. It is the Democratic Party that can effect the change that America needs. The chair reminds all delegates that the presidential nominating petitions must be submitted to the office of the secretary no later than 6 p.m. on Tuesday. Vice presidential nominating petitions must be submitted to the office of the secretary no later than 9 a.m. on Wednesday. Petitions should be delivered to the secretary's office, which is...
Well, folks, I guess that means that if you want to run for president of the United States under the Democratic Party, you still can. There's still time, Howard Dean says. You might not have many delegates in this hall, but apparently, according to formal convention, you can still apply. Let's go back to Howard Dean.
...of Ray Chu. I also want to thank the hardworking men and women, union members all, who worked so hard to get this hall ready for this convention. And I am now pleased to introduce former Vice Chair of the Democratic National Committee and former Colorado State Senator Polly Baca to lead us in the invocation.
Okay, so this is the part that Guy said I was insulting everyone, that you might find less interesting the invocation and so forth. I apologize. I didn't mean to say that everyone was boring, but I did think you'd want to hear the official opening of the Democratic National Convention, and also encourage you folks to call in and ask me the kind of questions that you might want to know what it looks like up here in the skybox. I want you to know I am working. I've been working feverishly without lunch to get a camera going. And I may not get it successfully in this hour, but I think by the time I get to Peter's show tonight, 9 to 11 Eastern Time, 8 to 10 Central, 7 to 9 Mountain, that's where I am here, and 6 to 8 Pacific Time, right after Bob Kincaid's show, I hope to show you live coverage of me and the convention by video, which would be a first on the horn. I'm proud to say that I would be the first on the horn to give you live video coverage, and then hopefully we're going to have that later on with, Guy and me tomorrow. Now, Guy and I are going tomorrow, all 12 to 6 Eastern Time, figured out in your own time zone, 11 to 5 Central, 10 to 4 Mountain where we are, 9 to 3 Pacific Time. We're going to do a tag team. You heard some of Guy and I talking a little bit with each other. Well, we'll be going back and forth and also trying to round up guests and also visiting the protest sites. I know that Guy definitely wants to do that. Maybe he can go do that during Bob's show. We'll hear from everyone we can. Coming up, probably in this hour, will be Congressman Joe Huffle of Pennsylvania. He's a Democrat, of course, and someone who I vaguely knew working on the Hill. And, you know, if you want to ask him the tough questions, I know many of you have. I've been reading the chat room and hearing some of the things people are saying about people like Nancy Pelosi. You know, call in. Call in. Let's have him hear what you have to say. Many of you don't get a chance to speak to a member of Congress very often, and here is your chance. Toll-free number, of course, is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Bob is also letting me know to tell you that during his show there may be some breaks for either Guy or me to come in and comment more on the convention, or also to play the convention feed. Now, we have a terrific feed live into the convention hall. You heard it. I hope it worked well. I'm told it did work well. You heard Howard Dean. And so anytime anything goes on the floor that I, in my humble judgment, find interesting, I may go right to the floor and play it. Look who is here. Congressman Joe Huffel of Pennsylvania. Actually, Guy, I think I'd like to see him to sit in your seat because your mic is working. Congressman, why don't you come over here on my left? Congressman, I haven't gotten all the TV stuff in time. I'm just going to have to work on that a little bit later. I apologize for that. Right now it's audio only, but this is radio. That's what it's all about.
This is great stuff. It's a great opportunity, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. You know, you were in Congress at the same time I was working in Congress on House Judiciary Committee, House Homeland Security Committee, back at the time when the Democrats were a minority. And at least for me, it was kind of a dispiriting experience. I don't know how you felt. You were in Congress a long time, weren't you?
Just 6 years.
Oh, just 6 years.
And it was a great privilege, but it was frustrating not to be able to get anything done day to day.
So that was 98 to 2004.
That's correct.
So you had 2 years under Bill Clinton and then...
4 years under President Bush.
How did it change in Congress? You were, of course, in the minority in the House all during that time. How did the agenda change from the 2 years under Bill Clinton to the 4 years under Bush?
Well, we had a progressive White House with a agenda under Bill Clinton dedicated to economic development and national health care and things that I really cared deeply about. Under George Bush, it became a hyper-partisan gridlock in the House with the Republicans not wanting to deal with any Democrats at all. And it was impossible to get anything done.
So now I know there was a massive gerrymandering scheme in Pennsylvania. The Republicans were determined to take a state that, let's face it, is a blue state. I mean, it's close to the line, I admit it. It's not a pure, it's not a Massachusetts or a Rhode Island, but it's a state that has voted for the Democrats in the at least the last four presidential elections. And they tried to make it so that they had a majority or even a supermajority in the House from your state.
They did, but the Republicans really messed up. They pulled that rubber band, they stretched it way too thin, and it turns out in 06, the Democrats had great victories in Pennsylvania in the House, and we now control the delegation by a 12-7 margin.
That's amazing. That's very good. Now let me ask you. I got to, you know, part of the things we do is we have our own critiques over here, even among the Democratic Party. Now, to be fair, you left in 04. I know you ran against Senator Spector. I'm sorry you didn't prevail.
Well, thank you.
He was a tough one to beat. He's been around a long time.
He's a very tough guy to beat, and but it was a very invigorating experience for me. I enjoyed it very much.
And a Democrat took your seat, so you didn't lose the seat. But here's the thing. A lot of Democrats, I have to say, while they're excited about the prospect of Barack Obama, they're less pleased about the performance in Congress. Now, maybe they're hopes were raised too high by the Democrats taking the majority in 2006, but a lot of them are saying to people like Nancy Pelosi, why is impeachment off the table? Isn't this a lawless president? Why aren't you holding people in contempt, forcing them to testify more often? How do you address some of that critique?
Well, I think Speaker Pelosi does not want to have a series of recriminations and personal attacks and political bitterness in the House of Representatives, which the Republicans, of course, created when they impeached Bill Clinton. And it was the short-term undoing of the Republican Party that they went after Bill Clinton on impeachment. So Speaker Pelosi doesn't want to repeat that.
See, I understand that politically, but a lot of my listeners are saying, now, wait a minute. Bill Clinton, at worst, lied about sex. I mean, that's what, I mean, whether he told the full truth about a sex act. Here we got with George W. Bush, torture. in violation of the Eighth Amendment. Spying on hundreds of millions of Americans in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Secret prisons, lying to get us into war. That these things, unlike Bill Clinton, really are impeachable offenses, and the Democrats should do something about it.
Well, I understand that argument totally. I think what the Democrats have to do is win legislatively. I think Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to use up a whole lot of progressive enthusiasm and energy over an impeachment operation. I don't think the American people want George Bush impeached. I think they want him out of office. And what's frustrating to me is that we've not had the legislative successes that I would like to see the Democrats have.
Is that because of the filibustering Senate, mostly?
It is. We can't get a veto-proof majority in the Senate, and so the president in the distinct minority can still block the legislation he doesn't like. I think, though, that the president will go down in history as the worst president we've had, who's done the most harm to this country for the very reasons you just announced, or detailed, I should say. He's really hurt our status around the world, misled us into war, and returned huge financial irresponsibility to the federal government. So I think that's going to be the legacy of George Bush. Is a failed presidency that is going to hurt the Republican Party for a generation.
Now, your home state, Pennsylvania, as we talked about, it's not a blue state, maybe like Rhode Island or Massachusetts, but it is a state that voted for the Democrat who was running, Gore, Kerry, and also Bill Clinton for the last two times before. Some people say that Joe Biden, being from a neighboring state of Delaware, will help in Pennsylvania. Do you think Pennsylvania is a lock for the Democrats this year?
Not a lock, but Biden does help. I think Senator Obama was in very strong position already in Pennsylvania without the vice presidential pick. And, in fact, the last state poll had Obama 8 points ahead of McCain in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
But Biden will help tremendously, not so much where the Democrats are already strong in Philadelphia and the suburbs where I come from, where Biden's well-known and popular, but in the western part of the state, where people are more conservative culturally, where the Democrats are, kind of shot and beard Democrats who are worried about the economics and can be distracted by the social issues, Biden, I think, will keep them home. I think Biden will be able to speak to those blue-collar Democrats in western Pennsylvania and make sure they stay with the Democratic ticket.
Well, let me ask you about a state that borders western Pennsylvania, a state that had Kerry won, he would be president today, a state that if Barack Obama wins, I'm fairly sure he will be our next president. I'm talking about Ohio. How does Joe Biden help, if he does, in Ohio?
I think for the same reasons that he will appeal to western Pennsylvanians. Ohio is a working class, family-oriented state. Biden is the salt of the earth. He's been in the Senate a long time, a lifetime, 36 years or something, and yet he hasn't put on airs. He hasn't lost his common touch. He returns home every single night on the Amtrak train from Washington to Wilmington, Delaware. Not only does he get home every night, but he knows the names and responds to the family problems of every conductor on those Amtrak trains.
Sure,
he knows
their
children's names and
right.
Their grandchildren. I mean, he just takes things to heart and takes his responsibilities personally. I mean, he hasn't lost that common touch, which a lot of Washington politicians have.
Well,
I think that's why Biden will relate to working families across the country.
Let me ask you this. Pennsylvania, as I know you know, went heavily for Hillary Clinton. And of course, a lot of that isn't anti-Barack Obama. A lot of that is support for the terrific work Hillary Clinton did and, of course, her husband, the last Democratic president. But one of my questions, and it's really broader than Pennsylvania, is there still a lot of introduction Barack Obama has to do to the country? He still is relatively new on the political scene, unlike Joe Biden. What do you think Barack Obama has to do in September and October? We only have 2 months, and then comes the election. What does he have to do to reintroduce himself to, maybe not to Democrats, but to independents and those who could vote either way?
Well, it really starts here at the convention, where he'll have a tremendous amount of attention, of course. He has to connect, I believe, on two basic themes. One is economic policy. He's got to make sure that the American voters believe that he will be good for their pocketbooks, and he's got to make sure that people believe he will keep them safe. So he's got to show knowledge and strength on the national security issues. He knows that. He's working hard on it, and I think he'll be successful. Barack has been something of a force of nature, a political force of nature in the last year. Remarkable accomplishments.
The crowds have been amazing. I mean,
astonishing. I mean, and
every young person I talk to is just is amazed and think he's going to be the greatest president. Although I got to tell you, some of the people I talked to in their 60s and 70s and 80s are less supportive, are less sure. I mean, I think perhaps older people are more conservative by nature. I don't mean big C, but small C for change. What can he do to reach out to that older demographic?
Well, I think those pocketbook issues are critical. He's got to address the issues that people talk about around that proverbial kitchen table.
Social
Security, they really do talk about that.
Exactly, healthcare.
And national security. I mean, people are worried about terrorism, and rightly so. I mean, it is a huge international threat, and Senator Obama needs to address it, as he has been, needs to fight back against the Republican smears.
Well, let's talk about those smears, because it's very strange to me, this smear that Obama is an elitist. Here, John McCain can't remember how many homes he has. You know, most of us remember. I have one home. Some people have no home. Some people, very, you know, good, you know, well-off people have two homes. But when you get over five, apparently it's hard to remember. And yet they characterize Barack Obama as an elitist. And I'm thinking, it's interesting to me, he's not a elitist wealth-wise. He's an elitist education-wise. He is president of the Harvard Law Review, whereas John McCain was not in the top 99% of his class in Annapolis. He was in the bottom 1%. Is it that Republicans think that Americans want a president who's just dumber than they are?
I don't know. The Republicans are willing to smear, tear down, divide, play one group against another. That's what they do. And they're willing to attack Democratic candidates. And if we don't fight back, we suffer. Dukakis didn't fight back. Gore didn't fight back. Kerry didn't fight back.
So what does Obama have to do without ruining his image as really a nice guy?
Well, he needs to do, frankly, what he's been doing. In the primary season, Obama fought back. I was always impressed that he came back at Hillary or Hillary's spokespeople, same news cycle, with a sharp retort or a response or a counterpunch or whatever was needed. I didn't always like it because I was a Hillary
supporter.
Yeah, right. But it impressed me that he learned the lesson of Dukakis and Gore and Kerry. You can't sit back and assume people understand. You can't assume people understand lousy smears when they hear them. You got to fight back. So Obama knows that. He's been good at it. That's why he won. That's why he won. He fought back.
Well, and that one last question that relates to the Hillary supporters, and of course you were one of them. One of the big things that people are talking in the hall, one of the things about being in the hall versus watching on TV or listening to the radio at home, is you get to hear all the scuttlebutt. And one of the big things that conservatives are saying in Fox News and even just sort of middle-of-the-road news organizations is, oh, well, the Hillary supporters are angry. They're not going to support Barack Obama. Now, I don't see that in the hall, but you're closer with them. You were a Hillary supporter. Is Obama going to have trouble bringing some of those, or a large portion of them, over to his side?
No, I don't think so. I think most Hillary supporters recognize the reality. They want to win the White House. They all admire Obama, always have. And I think most Hillary supporters are in fine shape. But there is talk that, and some in the press, in the last couple of days, have been looking for any evidence that either Hillary or Bill are out of joint or not happy.
They're looking for anything.
Right. And I must say, if for any reason the Clintons were not enthusiastic for Obama, if they held back, if they weren't 100% in, that would cause a problem for the party.
Of course it would.
I don't think that's going to happen.
But Hillary Clinton wants a roll call vote. And help me out, is that vote on Tuesday or Wednesday?
Wednesday.
Now, that seems awfully late. Wouldn't you want to hold that early, get it over with? I mean,
well, but historically, Wednesday night is when you have the roll call.
It is.
And it'll be interesting to see how she addresses this tomorrow night when she speaks.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. She's speaking, and then the roll call votes. It'd be easier for her to speak after she already lost.
Well, perhaps. And I don't know how she's going to present the case. I mean, she wants to support the Obama campaign.
But she's got a real problem because at the end of the day, she wants to win, and now she's got to basically tell, is she going to tell her delegates? I don't know. It's a tough thing. I wouldn't want to write her speech.
I don't know what she's going to say. I mean, I would like to have an opportunity to vote for Hillary, but not if it hurts the Obama cause.
Now, are you a super delegate?
Well, I'm a at-large Clinton delegate.
So you are a Clinton delegate,
yes,
from Pennsylvania.
I am
that's very interesting to me. Now, Clinton won Pennsylvania.
She did.
You're an at-large Clinton delegate. I assume that means come Wednesday you're going to cast your vote, your first vote for Hillary Clinton.
That is correct. But now remember, she has dropped out of the race and endorsed Obama.
Right. So how does this work?
It would be okay with me if there was no symbolic vote for Hillary. It would be okay with me if we nominated Obama by acclamation. But there are some Hillary folks that want, you know, the
traditional
pleasure of voting for Hillary. And that's fine as long as Obama and Hillary have worked it out, which I believe they have. Then it's not harmful. But it will be important for Senator Clinton tomorrow night to make that clear.
Well, here's an idea that I've been floating around, and you know both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama better than I do, though I've met them both. Hillary Clinton for Supreme Court Justice. What do you think?
She's got the brains.
She certainly does.
She really does.
At the Yale Law School.
Now,
she'd take that job, don't you think?
I don't know. You know, there's no question being a Supreme Court justice, as any judge, you are isolated. You lose your ability to talk with people. And I don't know whether Mrs. Clinton would like that or not, but she certainly got the ability and the brains. She'd be a fine Supreme Court justice.
She would, and she'd have it for life, unlike presidency that's not for life. Thank you so much for coming here on the Inside Scoop. I really appreciate your
time.
Well, folks, you heard it. That's Congressman Joe Huffel giving the, I think, what's the standard thought around here among those that support Hillary Clinton. Yeah, I mean, they would have preferred her, of course. They voted for her, but they're more than willing to support the cause. I know now we've got Philip on the line. Philip, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hello. It's a bit hard to hear you just because they got all kinds of music and stuff in the background. So,
I'll try and shout a little bit. That's usually what I do anyhow. This thing that you were saying with Pelosi, with her not wanting to discuss stuff and all that, I find that to be a crock. You know, she recently said that, again, you know, if there's any evidence of any wrongdoing, then maybe we check into it. You know, there's loads of evidence that the Bush crime family have committed a number of crimes, war crimes, et cetera. There's no excuse to it. And the protesters outside, I've got a couple of people I know here in San Diego that went over to Denver to protest down there. And the reason a lot of these people are protesting is it doesn't really have to do with Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or anything like that. It has to do with the people that worked in 2006. Really, really hard to campaign and get Democrats to the majority. And they felt like they were let down by Pelosi, who took his convictions off the table. And that's why a lot of these people are out of the protest.
Well, I'll tell you, Philip, these are issues that I've dealt with before, but they are important ones. You don't have to convince me. Or most Democrats, for that matter, of the incredible crimes of George W. Bush. I detailed just a very short list of them to Congressman Huffel. In fact, if you go to my website, RadioInsideScoop.com, there's a clip at the very... Never mind. It's not there now because I just redid my website. Anyway, you can still find it. I'll put it up there. But I did a long list of lawlessness where it took me, I think, 7 minutes to detail all of the many crimes that the Bush administration has done. The reason for Nancy Pelosi taking the stand she did, and I know you don't like it, and so I'm not going to defend it, but I will explain it. The reason why she does it is entirely political. And it's exactly what Congressman Joe Huffel said. She didn't bring impeachment to the table because she didn't think they'd win. It's as simple as that. Even if
I tell you what, Mark, I'm tired of people playing politics, and this is what we've got to change in the Congress to get some politicians and people in there that are progressive Democrats that actually give a damn more about this country and the Constitution rather than winning a damn election. You know what I'm saying?
But here's so here's the question, and I think it's an interesting practical one, Philip. We do not have the votes in the Senate to throw Bush or Cheney out of office. We absolutely don't. If every Democrat votes for it, even if Joe Lieberman, quasi-Republican, votes for it, that's 51 votes. It's simply not possible. Would you be willing to bring an impeachment proceeding against Cheney and Bush, bring all the evidence forward, lose, and let's say Pelosi's right, and maybe you can disagree that she's right, and we'll talk about that, but let's say she's right that if they bring impeachment, and Congressman Huffle believes that too, the Democrats will lose seats in the House, lose seats in the Senate, and McCain will be your next president. Do you think that bringing an impeachment proceeding that will not succeed would be worth having a Republican Congress and a Republican president for the next 4 years?
Well, no, I wouldn't have the impeachment hearing now. I'm talking about 2006, where everybody was out working their butts off to make sure we got some kind of majority in Congress. And the main thing people wanted was a little bit of the truth. We didn't want John Conyers buried in the basement someplace with his hearings. We wanted this stuff to come out. And one of the problems I have with Barack Obama and Clinton is, you know, we're talking about, your guest just talked about terrorism, and everybody's concerned about that in the United States. This guy needs to come out clearly and say, look, what we're going to do is this. We're not going to go around and goad other countries into wars for profit. You know, if there is a real, genuine threat to this country, then we'll take care of it. But we're not going to go around to Georgia and Russia and point fingers and have little Condi Rice run around pointing her finger like we're holier than thou when we've invaded the country ourselves. That's what Barack Obama needs to start saying.
I'll tell you this. I was with you until you made that last point, and let me tell you why. First of all, I think that in terms of us invading countries that didn't attack us, Barack Obama is 100% clear on this point. He has said umpteen times that the Iraq War is a war that should never have been authorized and should never have been waged. He was, as you know, very early an opponent of the war. He opposes every single violation of law that Bush does, whether it's illegal wiretapping or torturing people or extraordinary rendition or, I mean, lying to get us into war, you name it. Obama's on the correct
side. Well, how can he just vote for the FISA bill, though, Mark?
Give me a chance, Philip. Let me just tell you where I disagree with you. I do not believe, and I have had this argument with others before at Pacifica stations where I'm heard in D.C., I do not believe that just because the United States has done horrific, awful, illegal things and killed innocent people and all these things that I talk about on the air and I concede from the outset, that doesn't mean that I can't turn around and say Russia shouldn't invade Georgia too. It seems to me it's perfectly fair to say the United States shouldn't torture, Russia shouldn't torture. The United States shouldn't invade a sovereign country that never attacked it, Russia shouldn't invade a sovereign country that never attacked it. I don't believe that because the United States has lost its moral authority under George W. Bush, that none of us have the right to criticize other countries as well. And it's my hope that Obama brings back American moral authority and that all of us continue to criticize both the U.S. and other countries when they do wrong.
Absolutely. I agree with you with that. But we have to remember what happened with that Georgia conflict to begin with. I mean, Karl Rove was over there. There's evidence that Bush was in contact with these people in Georgia, and they invaded the southern Osetia region down there, and then Russia came in to protect those people, and blah, blah, blah. You know the story with it, but you know what the world sees the hypocrisy, and what I'd like Barack Obama to do is get rid of that hypocrisy we have. I'd like for us to be a country where we have a leader like Barack Obama, or somebody strong like that, that does what, you know, you know what I'm saying, you know. Let's get back to the way we used to be.
I agree. I tell you where, and listen, you know, I fight people on my right, I fight people on my left. Part of my problem is the people that say that anyone who is an ally of Bush must be a bad person and anyone who Bush hates must be a good person. I've heard some people on the far left praise Iranian President Ahmadinejad just because Bush hates him. I condemn what Georgia did. I think they went over the line, too. I think Russia went way more over the line than Georgia did. But at the end of the day, Georgia is a democracy. It is elected democracy. It was trying to reach out to the West. And, you know, I see Russia crushing it not to protect the South Ossetians. They crushed it because they want to extend their empire, frankly, for the same kinds of reasons that we went into Iraq for oil. So I just say be consistent. I condemn, you know, illegal actions wherever they occur, whether they occur in our country or whether they occur abroad.
don't get me wrong, I wasn't excusing what Russia did over there.
Fair enough.
Just what I'm saying, just, you know, like I said, the hypocrisy in it. But I'd like Barack Obama to come out stronger on things like that. If it's a terrorism issue and it's a real terror threat, you know, something we need to worry about, let's worry about it. But we cannot go around threatening other countries and picking wars. Like, for instance, the Iran thing, you know, with the, they're making nuclear weapons. We're being, that's the same kind of crap we were fed before we invaded Iraq. The same thing. Weapons of mass destruction. Fear, fear. And I just wanted to take an opposite line of that more in the press as the months go on after the convention.
It's hard to know the truth. I'll tell you. You know, when Bush wanted to go into Iraq, I was in Congress at the time working for people like John Conyers on the House Judiciary Committee. And at the time, some Democrats were skeptical, including, by the way, John Conyers, my immediate boss, Barney Frank, and others were not. And basically they said, well, the president says so, so, you know, well, maybe it's true. It'll be interesting for me if Obama says that Iran is, you know, developing nuclear weapons and is a real threat. I'd be more inclined to believe him. You're right. I don't believe anything that comes out of this administration. But I don't want us to turn inward. One of the reasons I really like the pick of Joe Biden is that it shows that that we're not going to be an isolationist country. Yes, we shouldn't attack countries that never attacked us. But Joe Biden is very much an interventionist, very much out there recognizing that we should promote democracy all over the world, not necessarily or even primarily through military means. I don't think that's the way to do it. But through, you know, sanctioning the bad guys economically, supporting countries that are struggling. I'm glad Biden's there because I think it shows that we're not isolating ourselves from the rest of the world. There is a way to do this thing right. And I think Biden is a very creative man. I'll tell you something. I had a conversation with Joe Biden a year ago, right before he ran for president. It was interesting. It was a radio convention, and Joe Biden gave like a 30-minute speech inside the hall. Not many people said anything. You know, in radio conventions, most of the people are conservative. And he came out in the hall, and I asked him one question. One question, it was about the division of Iraq into Shia, Sunni, and Kurds. And we spent an hour outside the hallway, and I guarantee you, Joe Biden was as involved in that conversation as I am. I mean, I'm pretty... you know, I stick to it when I got such a conversation. But he did too, and he and I went back and forth. And I'll tell you this: I didn't always agree with everything he said, but he's an extremely intelligent man, and he's someone who's really striving to find answers. I mean, I think I convinced him on a few things. I think he convinced me on a few things, and I'm really looking forward to having a president and a vice president who's willing to listen rather than the stubbornness of a George W. Bush.
Absolutely, and I'm more secure now with the Obama ticket with Joe Biden on it. I like Joe Biden a lot. I like that he speaks out as well and isn't afraid to speak his mind. And some people accuse him of being kind of long-winded. Well, I'm long-winded too, but I think that's a good
thing. Well, I am too, and that's why I'm in radio. Hey, Philip, I really appreciate it.
And a video camera expert, huh?
Well, no, I'm going to get that video camera up. I am determined. You know, when I get on something, you ask Guy James, you ask Bob Kincaid, when I am determined, I am determined. And by hook or by crook, I am going to get a video camera up there. When I do, I'll put the feed on my website at radioinsidescoop.com. I'll give it to the head-on radio people. We will get video feed some way. But thanks for calling, Philip.
I can't believe the location you got there. That's fabulous, Matt.
Oh, beautiful. You can see the
pictures. Look, the pictures are up on the Head On Radio website. I'm throwing a couple of pictures.
I'm really hoping to show y'all the video to do that. Thanks for your call, Philip. I appreciate it. Before we go to a break, I want to go a little bit to the floor. I want you to hear what's going on. Here's Howard Dean, who is talking again.
Hearing none, the chair calls the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye. All those opposed by saying no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. And the report of the Credentials Committee is hereby adopted. Thank you.
Now, this is kind of interesting. The report of the Credentials Committee was just adopted. If you followed the technical battle between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, the Credentials Committee was possibly a bone of contention. There was a big question of how to count Michigan and Florida. They finally decided on a half vote. I shouldn't say finally, because just a few days ago, Barack Obama, having sewn up the nomination, decided to give Michigan and Florida a full vote. And all those battles were to be done in the Credentials Committee, and now they have formally approved the Credentials Committee. I'm looking out over the hall, And it's a pretty cavernous hall, and I'm sure at some point every seat will be full. Right now I'd say, oh, it's maybe a third of the seats in the hall. See, that's why I need my video camera. I could show y'all what's going on and give you the video. Let's take a quick break. I'll play with the video camera a bit. Probably won't get it working in the next 2 minutes, but also give you a chance to call in. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to continuing live coverage of the Democratic National Convention from the Pepsi Center on the Horn, America's liberal voice.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Here's a little test for you. Identify the following water-saving devices around your home. Using water wisely is important since our growing population puts pressure on this limited resource. Ready? That's water-saving device number 19, your outdoor faucet. Check faucets, sprinklers, and hoses for drips or leaks to save water and money. That's your toothbrush, water-saving device number 54. Turn the faucet off while you brush and save up to 25 gallons a month. It's water-saving device number 11, your water bill. If it's unusually high, you could have a leak. Learn to detect and repair leaks by contacting your water provider. Last clue? That's BeWaterSmart.net, a helpful website full of water-saving tips from the Water Conservation Coalition and your local water provider. There are a number of ways to save water, and they all start with you. Water, use it wisely.
Now back to live convention coverage from the Pepsi Center in Denver. Brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. Here's Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'll tell you, I've been working really, really hard on that TV camera, and I've got it up now. It is streaming, but I don't have the link yet for the stream. But I am proud to say it will be streaming. I don't know that I've got the link to you yet. But I'm going to try to get that and get that to you on the air. Basically, as I said, this is the early stages here. It's just filling in. It's funny because I've been here since 5 in the morning, so I'm like, where are all these people? You know, it's I don't know how I'm going to survive this. I'll tell you, I was on the Fox local channel this morning, and it was good for me. In fact, a lot of people told me they saw me here in Denver. I'm hoping to let people know about the Inside Scoop, let people know about the Horn, and that we're out there, and to reach out to a larger audience. And so I was on local television this morning, and I've been here at the convention hall since 5 in the morning. It is now, 3:30 p.m. Denver time, and I'm going, of course, till 11 p.m. tonight, and I don't know, maybe even into the horn section. So I'm doing okay now. I may be worn out tomorrow, and I would like to eat at some point. I want to thank Philip for his call. It was very thought-provoking. And also say I've been reading into the chat room and some of the things that Poppy's been saying, talking about the fact that only if we had hearings on impeachment, that if we had the hearings, the evidence would have come out, and that would have changed people's minds. I'll tell you this, Poppy. I agree with you on that. While I understand Nancy Pelosi's reluctance to put impeachment on the table now, and you know, off the table doesn't mean never. It means not now. Of course, at this point, it means never because we have an election in 2 months. But I do think there should have been more hearings into these things. And as you know, my friend John Conyers, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and you can actually watch this interview on my website, RadioInsideScoop.com. I interviewed him, and I asked him very frank questions about this, and also about specifically holding hearings just so people could learn the truth. And the problem is that Bush administration officials, when subpoenaed by Congress, are different from every presidential administration in American history. Every other president respected the law. To some extent. I mean, Nixon didn't completely, but everyone at least respected a congressional subpoena. And when they were ordered to appear, they showed up. Bush simply is above the law, so he claims. And so when Karl Rove gets subpoenaed about the Don Siegelman affair, many of you know the imprisoning of the Democratic governor of Alabama because he was in Karl Rove's way, or in fact Monica Goodling, who, in my view, under direct orders from Karl Rove, broke the law, throwing out some really strong attorneys in the Justice Department because what do? They prosecuted Republicans for things like bribery and throwing out Democrats for refusing to prosecute Democrats for frivolous cases. That Monica Goodling, I don't think, was alone. Just like I don't think Linda England, the famed torturer of Abu Ghraib, was alone. I just don't think these young women were behind these policies. Not because they were young and because they're women, because they weren't in charge. They were low down on the totem pole. These are the kinds of things. Torture was approved, we now know, by Dick Cheney, and I have no doubt that the politicization of the Justice Department was done by Karl Rove. How do I know this? Because Karl Rove has said that he will tell lots and lots of lies to Congress as long as the media is not there and he's not put under oath. But see, if he's put under oath and he tells a lie, well, that's perjury. And he could go to jail for a very long time. So Karl Rove said this: I will tell you everything as long as you don't make me tell the truth. As long as you allow me to lie with impunity, I will do it for you. Well, thank you, Karl Rove, but that's not the standard. The standard is you subpoena, they tell an oath, and the witness has got to tell the truth, or they can be punished. And I felt that John Conyers needed to take very strong steps to punish the people that refuse to show up. Now, traditionally, as I've talked about before, the way that Congress does it is contempt. Congress did hold Harriet Myers and Josh Bolten in contempt. The Judiciary Committee held Karl Rove in contempt, and I'm confident the entire House will as well. But that's not enough. You see, under most cases when you hold someone in contempt, under most lawful administrations, indeed every single one up to this one, when you hold someone in contempt, then the district attorney for the District of Columbia then takes the person and puts them in jail until they talk. Well, Bush has ordered the U.S. District Attorney for the District of Columbia to break the law, to not do it. Well, Congress, as many of you know, has an inherent power of contempt. They can grab someone and throw them in jail themselves. And I have been pushing John Conyers for a long time on this, and he's even joked with me about making Harriet Myers do the perp walk. So at the end of the day, I agree with Poppy. We should have brought this information to the light of the people. I don't know that it would have changed enough Republicans' minds for impeachment, but it was the role of Congress to bring this to people's attention. They couldn't do it because they were stonewalled, and I would have liked to have seen a whole bunch of Bush administration officials, heck, even Dick Cheney, along with Karl Rove, Harriet Myers, Josh Bolten, all of them sitting in the new renovated Capitol jail cell. That, to me, would have been a beautiful thing. But the Democrats are playing it safe, as they often do. They, at this point, the election is 2 months away, and they, like most Americans, are focused on the future. But I appreciated your question, Poppy. It's something I've been trying to do for a long time. Toll-free number 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Again, just to give you a feel for what's going on the floor, I'm now going to turn to the chairman of the Rules Committee, David Walter, speaking on the floor of the Denver Democratic National Convention.
Columbus Mayor Michael Coleman took office with the goal of improving the quality of life for the city's citizens. Mayor Coleman is working to build Columbus into a leading 21st century city through his commitment to improving the safety and quality of life in neighborhoods, building a more vibrant downtown, creating and retaining jobs, and building partnerships to solve community challenges. Maria Elena Durazo is the Executive Secretary Treasurer of the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor, which represents 800,000 workers in every key industry.
Okay, so you get the idea. There's a mayor of Columbus, Ohio. There's labor groups. There's all kind here. Guy is back sitting by my side watching all of this. And I don't know, Guy, any comments so far?
Well, you were right. Earlier you mentioned about some of the speakers. You made a comment about them.
And I said that some of them were boring.
Yeah. Tis true.
Now, you're insulting them, too. What you just accused me of.
I didn't use the word. I.
You just did, right now.
I didn't say it, actually.
You didn't say boring?
No.
I think we have the video. I think we have the audio, the archive.
I don't, Ben. Help me here. I don't think I actually used the word.
All right, listeners, did he use the word boring? Because I think he did. Look, I will say it. I'll say it again. There are some people who are exciting at the convention, and there's some people who are less than exciting. Sorry, David Walters, the Rules Committee. To me, you fall in the second category. I'll say it. I'll go out on a limb. I'll say it.
I'll stipulate to that.
But it is going to be an exciting night, so I do want you to stick with us. We've got Michelle Obama at the very end. She is the keynote speaker. But to me, what I think people are waiting for more than Michelle Obama is to hear Ted Kennedy. To hear him, this will probably be, and this is no insult to Ted Kennedy, it's just an honest discussion of his horrific condition, a very, very aggressive brain tumor. This will probably be Ted Kennedy's last great speech of his life. This will be his valediction. This will be his chance to say once and for all what a liberal stands for, what a Democrat should stand for. You know he's going to talk about health care. You know he's going to talk about Social Security. You know he's going to talk about the Democratic tradition of looking out for the little guy. He will show humor. And you know what? I don't think he's going to dwell too much on his condition. I'm sure he'll mention it. But I think that Ted Kennedy will give a speech that looks at the past, reminds us, of course, of his brother and both his brothers, frankly, and all the good work that they did, but really looks to the future. And it's really an amazing thing, I think, to imagine a man knowing he's going to die. I mean, let's face it, it's a fact. Knowing he's going to die probably in the next 6 months, maybe if he lasts a year. I'm told in this condition, if you last a year, you're one of the rare and the lucky ones. Ted Kennedy is knowing that this may be his last speech, and it'll be, I just think that this hall will be riveted. No disrespect to Michelle Obama. She's a great speaker. She's a very intelligent, wonderful woman. I think Ted Kennedy's going to steal the show tonight. What do you think, Guy?
I think if Ted speaks tonight, it'll be an electrifying moment from a true icon of American politics. Ted Kennedy has the ability, as everybody knows, to bring the house down. And if he speaks tonight, and if he's the Ted that we all know and love, he will definitely bring the house down tonight. I'm very much looking forward to it.
I am too, and I think that the delegates are too. They're definitely gonna. They're starting to crowd the hall a bit. At first, I said it was about, I don't know, a 20% full. I'd say we're up to 40%, Guy. What do you think? Am I being optimistic?
Yeah, I think you might be. It's
35%.
I see my Florida gang's all down there.
Yeah.
They're the ones in the pastels.
Speaking of your Florida gang.
Oh, no, let's not.
Oh, come on. You hear the word Florida.
Yeah.
And, of course, everyone thinks of 2000.
Yeah.
And now I'm told, I talked to someone from the Florida delegation, in fact, just today, and they said that there are paper ballots in Florida today, that even though there's a Republican administration that's going to, you know, try to keep voters away from the polls, at least today you won't get those horrible Diebold ballots. Is that right?
Yes. Most of the polling places in Florida have got the new machines.
The ones that have a paper record.
Right.
And the other thing I was told is that through the work of Robert Wexler and others, I just happen to be a big fan of Robert Wexler, that they made sure that the paper records are the official ballots. So if it's a contested race, they go by the paper ballots rather than by whatever the election machines say.
That's right. That's right.
Let me just give one shout-out to say that this is really a dramatic change and a really good change for the best. For Florida, I know Ohio now has paper records. We may actually get a fair election.
You think?
It's possible. Hey, before we go back to this, Barack Obama, there's a tape of him on the screen. Let's hear what he has to say.
People who are raising money in small increments, $25, $50, you can actually match the power of corporations and lobbies to actually influence what's going on in a place like Washington.
Okay, back to music. But you got the point. And one thing that Obama, the point that he was making, of course he wasn't here, he was on the big screen, was, you know, this is really a campaign that has done an amazing thing with small donations. Barack Obama has raised more than any presidential candidate at this point in American history, and the average donation is like $25. It's an amazing thing to think that, sure, individually we can't match the big corporations and the big donors, but actually all together, combining in the millions, we can actually have more power. The DNC has raised more than the Republicans.
Yes, they have, and it's about time. We are catching them. We are going to outspend them this year. I'm sure of that. But it is gratifying, you know, that Sally and John Q. Public are able to, the lunch bucket crowd, able to throw in a few bucks, whatever they can afford, especially in these times, to outspend the likes of Martin Marietta and those folks.
You know, it's really amazing because when a rich person spends money, particularly a rich corporation, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, let's face it, they expect something back. Halliburton knows if they give $100,000 to Dick Cheney and George Bush, they'll get back $2 billion or $5 billion. I haven't lost count. $100 billion? How much
is
Halliburton?
You know the percentage I saw of the money spent for the lobbying and what they get back in return?
No, what's that?
163,000%.
So that's 1,000 times. Yeah, that's about what I would think. About 1,000 times in the earnings. For every million they spend, they get $1 billion back from taxpayers. And, you know, that's a great bargain. You know, I would love to have an investment where I stick in $1,000 and get $1 million back.
I've been looking for that.
Well, I'll tell you how you do it. Guy, you got to buy your own member of Congress. What you do is you go down to the Senate and, you know, you start saying, well, you know, I would like wait. Nancy Pelosi's coming out. She's at least waving. I don't know if she's going to speak, but if she does, I want to go to that. You know what? Hold on. I'm trying to interrupt when things happen. Let's hear what Howard Dean says about Nancy Pelosi.
The Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, assuming this position in January of 2007, she served for 4 years as House Democratic leader and was the first woman to lead a major political party in Congress. Speaker Pelosi has represented California's 8th District since 1987, has been a leader in increasing educational opportunity, protecting workers, and promoting health care. Co-chair Kathleen Sebelius was first sworn in as governor of Kansas in January of 2003, and in 2005 was named as one of America's 5 best governors by Time magazine. She was reelected in 2006 and served as the chair of the Democratic Governors Association. At the heart of Governor Sebelius' administration is a commitment to growing the Kansas economy and creating jobs, ensuring every Kansas child receives a quality education, improving access to quality, affordable health care, and taking advantage of the state's renewable energy assets. Co-chair Mayor Shirley Franklin is Atlanta's first female mayor, the first African-American woman.
Let me say this while he's talking about someone else. If Nancy Pelosi speaks, and it looks like she's going to. Hold on, let me check my schedule here. Let's see here. I don't know. She's up on stage. I don't see how she can be up on stage and not speak, but she's not in the... Oh, yeah, there she is, Nancy Pelosi. I take it back. All right, Nancy Pelosi's on the schedule. If Nancy Pelosi speaks, and I expect her to, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to play the feed, and you're going to hear Nancy Pelosi without interruption by me. And then if it cuts on over to Bob's show, I hope Bob will understand. I'm just going to not interrupt her, let her finish, and then probably she'll finish. She'll be into Bob's show, and then he can cut into her and say whatever he wants to comment on the speech. Let me just, before she starts, say goodbye now, because I have a feeling she's going to go through the hour. Tell you that, of course, I'm very happy to be here in Denver. I'm very happy to be on the horn. I'm going to get to work on that video feed, and hopefully I can get it to you in the chat room. We'll play Nancy Pelosi. It'll go into Bob's show, and then Bob will come out of Nancy Pelosi. It'll come a little bit different here, but, hey, this is live. This is a convention. That's what we're going to do. So, again, Mark Levine here is signing off. Here is Nancy Pelosi.
I know I speak for all of us here when I thank you for your tremendous leadership. And I speak for my fellow co-chairs when I say what an honor it is to serve as co-chairs of the permanent chairs of this historic event. It is my privilege to serve alongside three outstanding women leaders of the 2008 Democratic National Convention. Governor Sebelius of Kansas has been introduced, Mayor Shirley Franklin of Atlanta, and with me here, State Senator Letitia Van de Put of Texas. It is now my privilege, as my first official act, to introduce the parliamentarian, Congresswoman Doris Matsui from our home state of California, who will give us a report of the parliamentarian, Doris Matsui. Thank you very much. And good afternoon, fellow guests.
Well, I apologize, okay? See, that's me not knowing all the schedule. I thought that Nancy Pelosi was going to take the last 5 minutes, so I bowed out so you could hear her, whether you agree with her or not. I thought you should hear her. But apparently her speech may not be till later. I'll tell you what's coming up, though. Right now this is the parliamentarian, Doris Matsui. But after that is one of my favorite people in the Democratic Party, and he's really kind of obscure. I like him partly because I know him personally, and he's such a great guy. After Doris Matsui, we're going to hear from Andy Tobias. Andy Tobias is the treasurer of the Democratic Party. And I got to know him because he wrote a very famous book that is a terrific coming-out book for all gay people. And if you're not gay, it's still a really, really terrific book to explain the coming-out process. It's called The Best Little Boy in the World. He wrote it under a pseudonym. In 1970, I think, 1972, the synonym is John Reed, R-E-I-D. You can still find the book and look it up. But here is a very frank story, and one that actually I found particularly comforting for me as he describes his coming out process at a time when he actually had to write with a pseudonym. Since then, he's made a tremendous amount of money. He's written a lot of financial health books. He is treasurer of the Democratic Party. But I'll tell you this, Andy Tobias has never given up that very friendly, very frank, very warm spirit. He has been particularly helpful to me personally when I started working in Washington, and he's going to come up after Doris Matsui. Hopefully, I don't know whether I'll pass to Bob before or after he talks, but hopefully we'll hear a little bit about him, just because I'm a big fan. You know, there are people in the party who I tolerate, people in the party who I dislike, people who are almost out of the party, like Joe Lieberman, who's going to speak for the Republicans. And then there's some people in the party like Andy Tobias who I just love. I just think he is the nicest guy in the world. You know, it's amazing to me. Some people are powerful people. I might like their politics, but I don't like them personally. Some of those I hate to even admit on the air because I think their politics are really good. Andy Tobias is to use the Jewish word, a real mensch. someone who is a good person in and out. And anyway, hopefully you'll get some of that under Bob. But my time is up. I've enjoyed it. I will be back. Don't worry. I'll be back during Peter's 2 hours from 9 to 11, 7 to 9 p.m. Denver time. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
This is live ongoing coverage of the Democratic National Convention from Denver. Brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org.